Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Words of the Wise podcast, hosted by me, Lexi Maynard. Our mission is to capture the words and wisdom of the world's elderly so that their story and legacy may last forever. Like what we're about? Then be sure to subscribe to receive instant updates on new episodes. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Words of the Wise Podcast or on Twitter at Words of W Podcast as well. Today's guest is Ron Litterist. As I had heard how great of a man he was prior to this interview, let's just say that our conversation did not disappoint my expectations. Here is episode 22, Ron Litterist.
Hi, I'm Rollin Nelson Litterist, but I'm known as Ron, and I'm 84 years old.
And you grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and have lived there for a majority of your life. How has the town changed now from when you were a kid?
Well, my family came here, my dad's family came here in 1847, and the reason that they came here was because Peoria had a lot of water and had a lot of ingredients for beer and alcohol. And in the late 1800s, the only federal tax what the government lived on was whiskey tax.
Oh.
And so Peoria became sort of the hub of that activity. And Peoria grew rapidly during the Civil War and afterwards. And in fact, in 1880, Peoria had over 100,000 people here.
Really?
But when they had the whole big scandal about the price fixing of whiskey, a lot of that cartel was broken up. And so from that point on, Peoria really done really well. And they wanted to be the state capital, and they lost that. They wanted the expressways to go through Peoria, and they didn't until probably 30 years ago. And so they wanted riverboat gambling. They didn't want riverboat gambling in Peoria, and so it went across the river, and all the revenue from riverboat gambling went someplace else beside Peoria. So Peoria has always sort of been on the short end of the stick, and so the cop population has sort of dwindled a little at a time over a number of years. So
yeah.
Peoria just lost the Caterpillar headquarters 2 years ago. They moved to Chicago. Still have a big presence in Peoria, but in the meantime, Peoria, in an effort to remain the second largest city in the state, took a whole area of property into the city and so they could maintain that position. Well, now, after Caterpillar had their big strike in the 80s and about 30,000 people left Peoria, Peoria's never regained. We're only about 105,000 in Peoria.
Oh, wow.
Now. So Peoria has a big area, but the population hasn't increased very much.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good place to live. It's a wonderful city.
Yeah.
But it has the problems of every mid-sized city, you know.
And what did the typical day in your childhood look like?
Well, if you count up my age, my childhood was during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And, of course, our whole life was consumed with the Second World War. I mean, every kid either had a Navy sailor suit or an Army outfit. We spent all our time digging trenches and foxholes, and we played Army all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was rationing. You'd go stand in line with your mother or your dad in line for meat, sugar, a lot of the commodities that we take for granted now. We had a vegetable garden because everybody had a victory garden.
Mm-hmm.
So you plowed up part of your yard to make a garden. So those are the kinds of, I mean, I went to school and came home and played with the neighbor kids, played war.
Yeah.
Which sounds sort of crazy now, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I have. I have one brother, 6 years younger than I am. The summer he has a condo in Lincoln Park in Chicago.
Oh.
And the rest of the year he lives in Boca Raton, Florida, on the ocean. And he has one son, and he's currently not married.
Would you say that you have a favorite childhood memory?
Well, I think the holidays were always a favorite memory of ours. We always spent New Year's Day with my dad's family. All my dad's family were German.
Oh.
My brother and I are the first mixture in that family.
Wow.
And my mother's family was Swedish.
Okay.
And my brother and I are the first part of her family that are not pure Swede. So holidays with both of our families were always a big deal.
Yeah.
My grandmother literally always made us eat something called sea scrout, which was made out of turnips or cabbage or something like that. We always hated that. We always, if for good luck, you had to have a spoonful of it. And so we always would try to find reasons to have stomach aches or some reason,
yeah.
So we wouldn't have to eat it. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. What did the typical Saturday night in high school look like for you?
Well, we lived in Peoria until I finished my sophomore year in high school. And Peoria at that time had three high schools, and the one I went to was on the north end of town and was the largest high school, and had about 2,500 in it.
Wow.
And when my mother was in a bridge club, and one of the gals in the bridge club was going to sell her house, and she lived north of town, and my mother loved her house. It was in the woods, and it was a really lovely house, and so my mother wanted to buy that house and move there, and so my dad said, well, we can buy a whole farm for the cost of that house.
Mm-hmm.
And so we bought a farm north of town and moved into a 1870 farmhouse that had been remodeled. And so I went to school in a town called Dunlap, Illinois, which is just now on the north edge of Peoria.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all farmers. Everybody in the school were farmers, and I was the only one that was not a member of the FFA.
Oh.
And I was the city boy, you know, when I came out there. And there were 32 in my class.
Oh, wow.
And I was the only one. So I went from a school that there were probably 700 in my class to a school that had 32 in my class. And I was the only one that went to college.
Really?
Yeah. And now that school is the biggest and most successful high school in the area.
Really? Wow.
Because over a period of 50 years, a lot of people moved out of the city and moved to that area. So I had a job. So Saturday nights, I had a job as a busboy at a steakhouse.
Okay.
Called Maple Shade. And so on Saturday nights, I was working bussing tables.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing.
And did you have any other jobs when you were younger?
Oh, yes. I started a paper route at 12. I begged my parents. I wanted to make my own money.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be able to spend my own money the way I wanted to spend it. So from the age of 12, I had a paper route until we bought the farm. But I think I had the paper route for about another 6 months after that, because we had the farm had a big chicken house.
Oh.
And I decided that I was going to raise chickens to get eggs, and I would sell. My paper route was in Peoria.
Uh-huh.
And I would sell eggs to
on your paper route?
To my subscribers on my paper route.
Oh.
And I did that because in Illinois at that time you could get a driver's license at 15. And so one of the deal moving to the out there to the farm was that I could have a car. Well, you know, you'd do anything for a car as a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could drive back from there, back into town, and do my paper route. And I did that and through for maybe 6 months after we moved there. And then after that is when I got the job at the steakhouse.
Yeah. So as we've been talking about your childhood, your younger years, what would you say is the greatest thing that your parents taught you?
Well, my parents had two things that were important to them. One was, no matter what you did, do it the best you could, because whatever you're doing, if you're doing your best, then you're satisfied with it. So in college, I had a job with the Peoria school system in the summer, and we would be digging post holes to put in railings around stadiums and parking lots and things like this. And so one day we were out and it was 94 degrees and we were out doing that. Now the crew I was on were all teachers.
Oh.
and there was one other college student beside myself, and it was 90-some degrees out, and we were digging these post holes, and across the street, a woman brought over lemonade in a tray.
Oh.
And we thanked her for doing that. And she said, well, you know, if you went to school and got an education, you wouldn't have to do this. And they were all teachers, and we were in college. So I did that. I did that all through, I think even through my first year of law school, I did that.
Oh, wow.
So I always had a job. Erica is like that, too. Sometimes Erica had four jobs at the same time.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
She was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
She loved to work, and she loved to have her own money, and she loved to, you know,
mm-hmm.
she loved to be independent.
Yeah. So you went to Wabash College. What went into your decision to go there?
You know, I'm at a little farm high school. There were 32 in my class, and I decided that I wanted to go to an Ivy League school.
Mm-hmm.
So I started applying to Ivy League schools, and all of a sudden I get a call from a gentleman in Peoria. It said, I'm a graduate of Dartmouth College, and I'm interviewing all the applicants for admission to Dartmouth, and we'd like to see you.
Oh.
And so I went over to this man's house and talked to him for about an hour, and he explained that Dartmouth only allowed this area, which covered probably half of Illinois, to recommend two students for admission.
Mm-hmm.
And I was chosen with one of them, and I accepted, and we sent in money for accepting the position at the school.
Yeah.
In the meantime, my dad kept getting a call from a friend of his who was a lawyer and a state senator and who was a graduate of Wabash College, and he kept asking my dad to recommend to me to go over to Wabash College to see it. And uh-huh. I kept saying, well, you know, that's crazy. Why should I do that? Because I'm already going to Dartmouth. And so Senator Sowers said, well, you know, at least that way you will have an idea of what a men's school is like.
Yeah.
Because Wabash is only one of three outside of the Ivy League schools that were, you know, only men's schools.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I agreed to go over there for a rush party
mm-hmm.
at Phi Gamma Delta. And in those days, I think they still do there, they rush seniors in high school so that a lot of young men are pledged before they even arrive at school.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over there, grudgingly went over there, and I was so snowed that I went to the admissions office, got an application, came home. Of course, part of it was I'd gotten a bid. That was part of it. I came home and I said, well, I've decided I'm going to Wabash Pop College. And, of course, my parents were absolutely, you know, they had never seen the place.
Yeah.
And that's how I ended up at Wabash College.
Oh, that's funny. So you obviously joined Fiji. Can you talk about your time in fraternity life?
Sure. Oh, you know, I am an advocate of the Greek system, at least as it is in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the Greek system was instrumental in molding me.
Yeah.
In getting me to study and to learn and to juggle my life. And to, I mean, it had a great deal of effect on me. I really enjoyed it. You know, my pledge brothers are friends for life, and I mean, it has been an important part of my life. And as you have down in one of your questions, you evidently, when talking to Erica, found out that I had been an alumni advisor for a chapter of Bradley University for 14 years.
Oh, wow.
And the reason I did it was because they had a new chapter. When I became the alumni advisor, they were only about 5 years old. And so I wanted to instill in them the kind of experience that I had had
mm-hmm.
in my fraternity experience. Because I think that in some places now, I don't think they have the same goals and values that they have had at other times. And
yeah.
So I wanted to spend that time instilling instilling them the things that I thought were important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of the Greek system now, would you say that it's a different experience, the one that you had compared to the one that your grandson Charlie is currently living?
Well, when I went to, and I've explained this to parents when I at Bradley when I would see them. When I went to college, it was just after the Second World War, and we were in the middle of the Korean crisis, and so there were a lot of vets coming back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And the colleges were overwhelmed with the number of students they were getting, and they had no place to house them. So guess what? You know, here are these fraternities that their own members have paid for the house and, mm-hmm. and have all this room. So, gosh, we're going to be real nice to these fraternities, and in my case, sororities, but we're going to be real nice to them because they're our partners. They'll house them and we'll educate them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's different. Now the universities have built lots and lots of dormitories and apartments and all sorts of accommodations because they want to be the landlord.
Yeah.
And so now the Greek system is their adversary. It's a competitor. It's mm-hmm. no longer an associate that's helping us with a problem that we have. They're now competition for the same student mm-hmm. for a place to live. I think that has really started the separation between college administrations and the Greek system.
Yeah.
They're doing everything to try to get not only the tuition, but they're trying to get all the room and board as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it really has made the cooperation between them has gone away. And there isn't that responsibility of the Greek system, which felt that they were a part of the goal of the university in housing and feeding and teaching. Mm-hmm. So they just sort of lost their way. You know, they're off on the side here, sort of. The university doesn't care as much about them anymore, and so they're just sort of going off. They don't feel as needed as they did in those days, so it's mm-hmm. really a two-way street.
Yeah, and speaking of your grandson Charlie and DePaul, I obviously attend school with him, and you, of course, went to Wabash. Who do you root for during the Bell game?
Well, I haven't gone to a Bell game since he's in school.
Really?
I've gone to games.
Mm-hmm.
At DePaul to see him play, and of course I root for DePaul.
Yeah.
We were going to go to the Bell game this year, but of course there isn't a Bell game. But I would have rooted for Charlie at that game. I mean, he's my grandson.
Yeah.
You know, that's far more important than my alma mater.
Yeah, wait.
You can cut that out. You cut that part out when you show it to Chris.
Okay. So what would you say are your favorite memories from your time at Wabash?
When I went to Wabash College, DePaul was probably then around 1,200 students.
Mm-hmm.
And 60% of them were women and 40% were men.
Wow.
So in those days, it was easy to date women at DePaul because they didn't have as many men.
Yeah.
The other thing was that I would say maybe starting in 49, 50, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Up to that time, you know, it was a Methodist school originally.
Yeah.
And they weren't allowed to dance.
They weren't allowed to dance?
No.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they certainly weren't allowed to drink.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, Morris started about the time that I was in school, a little bit, maybe a year or two before.
Oh, okay.
But if a 21-year-old student was caught at Moore's, they were expelled from school.
Really? Oh, wow.
So it was not hard to get dates at DePaul.
Yeah.
And it was really easy to get dates for dance weekends at Wabash. And you had to write a note to the house mother of the sorority where your date was living, inviting her. It had to be the landlady of there were a lot of houses around Wabash where girls could stay for the weekend.
Oh, okay.
And you had to have a letter from the woman that owned the house inviting the girl to come to Crawfordsville before she was allowed to leave school. Well, when I was at Wabash, we never won the Monon Bell game.
Really?
In all 4 years I was there, we never won. And So we started, I don't mean me in particular, but students at Wabash started doing crazy things like we dug a W in the middle of the football field and filled it with gasoline and lit it. And that caused the DePauw administration to ban all Wabash students off campus.
Oh my gosh.
On campus. So then when we'd start meeting our dates downtown, then they banned us from the city limits.
Really?
So we'd meet our dates at the train station. That's where we meet our dates for about, it was a semester.
That's so interesting.
Rush week was the first week of school, the formal rush week, and of course those of us that were already pledged, were involved in rush at all. And so about, four or five of my pledge brothers, we went down to DePauw for the first time to look around. And we went in the Alpha Phi house, and it was Saturday night or maybe, I don't know, it wasn't anybody around. So we went down the basement, and there were lines, clotheslines full of clothes that were drying,
Yeah.
And we saw this row of panties that had embroidered on them Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Uh-huh.
So we thought that'd be a really fun joke to take those.
Yeah.
So we took them, and we took them back to Crawfordsville, and after a day or so, we started thinking, well, that wasn't really a good idea.
Yeah.
I think we'll send it back. So we get out a telephone book, and of course, we don't know much about the Greek system. We're just, we're just starting. So I'm looking for the down through the telephone book, and I remember Alpha Phi. And so I say, oh, yeah, Alpha Phi Omega, which is the Boy Scout honorary. And that's where we send them.
Oh, my God.
Thinking we were sending them to the Alpha Phi house.
That's hilarious.
So some poor young lady was missing her pants and couldn't figure out where they went. And the Alpha Phi Omega Boy Scout honorary probably wondered where the hell these came from. Oh, dear.
What did you major in?
I majored in history and political science. Because I knew that I was going to be a lawyer from the time I was 13 years old.
Wow.
14. Freshman in high school. I wrote a paper about it. And so I took things that I thought would be advantageous.
Yeah.
To going to law school. But I also had, I didn't declare as a major, but I also had enough hours for a major in public speaking. I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably had 30 hours of speech as well.
Wow.
And I was on the Speakers Bureau. I went out to Kiwanis clubs and Rotaries and women's clubs and gave speeches. And
mm-hmm.
One night I had a speech in a town about 30 or 40 miles away, and it was snowing. And it was really snowing hard, and I get there. And, there are probably four or five, six women there. That's all that were there. The group. And so I gave my speech, and when I was done, the chairman came up and she said, well, I'd like to present you with a check in appreciation for your coming here. And I said to her, there are so few people here. I really don't want to take the check. I said, I'm going to give it back to you and you can use it for something else. And she says, oh, good. We'll use it on our fund for better speakers. She didn't mean that I was not a good speaker. What she meant was the more expensive speakers. But she said, "I'll put in our fund for better speakers."
That's funny. So, what year did you graduate from Wabash?
I graduated from Wabash in 1958.
Okay,
and I started law school, and I did start law school at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I only stayed there 1 year.
Really? Why was that?
Well, I was dating a girl from DePauw whose dad was a lawyer in Chicago, and he wanted me to go to Harvard.
Oh.
And he kept sending in recommendations to Harvard. And I was leery about going there because I'm a Midwestern person. And so at that time, Harvard and Michigan were number one and two in the country as far as law schools were concerned, and so I decided to go to Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I came from a, a school of 650, and there are 1,200 in my freshman class in law school.
Oh, wow.
And it was sort of cutthroat.
Really?
Yeah. And I felt really uncomfortable there, so I thought, well, maybe I really don't want to be a lawyer after all. You know, I've just always said I want to be a lawyer. So I came home, and this same senator who was a lawyer, to see him, and I said, I'm leaving law school. I don't like it. Nonsense. That's just nonsense. Of course you're going to law school.
Yeah.
I said, well, I really didn't like that law school. He said, well, where would you go? And I thought, well, I'll go someplace close to Wabash. So I said, oh, I'll go to Indiana Law School. I said, fine, I'll call and arrange it.
Oh, wow.
So then I finished up Indiana University.
Okay. Wow. So you ended up in Bloomington.
In Bloomington. And the law school was right next to the Feigen house.
Okay.
And so I lived in an apartment. I don't know if you're knowledgeable about Bloomington, but I lived on Fest Street that ran into 3rd, and Fest Street ran right into the front door of the Fiji House.
Okay.
And so I ate my meals at the IGM House. So I really got, you know, I got more than 4 years out of fraternity life. I really got another 2 more out of it.
Yeah. So what are your favorite memories from your time in Bloomington then?
Let's see. I enjoyed dating there. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the people I was with in law school. I had a cousin, and then the next year I had a cousin come to Indiana, and she had been at University of Iowa, and she transferred to IU.
Uh-huh.
And so I had a lot of interaction with her while she was there. Bloomington is a really neat town. Mm-hmm. And of course, my son went there also. So I got another whole round of life in Bloomington, Indiana, when he was there.
Yeah. What would you say to someone who is considering becoming a lawyer?
I would say to them that the profession has changed a lot over the last 50 years. And when I was in law school, not everybody went on to practice law because it was such a good way to start into business or into other areas.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard now for young people to start in law school, to start in practicing after law school now, because there are so many people going into the field. And so the competition for jobs now in that field is very high. And so you really have to be dedicated to actually practicing law to want to do it, because it isn't worth just going to law school because you think, oh, gee, it'll be good for me in business or something else.
Yeah.
You really have to be dedicated to being a lawyer and practicing law to make it worth your while to go through what you have to go through, get through law school. Medical schools, they weed out everyone in the application process they don't think will go through school.
Mm-hmm.
Law school is entirely different.
Really?
Law schools admit everybody, and then they weed them out during the process of being in school.
Oh.
So to that extent, just to say, oh, gee, I think if you need to be a lawyer, is really not enough to go through that experience. You need to really want to do it.
Yeah. And I know that you said that you knew from the time you were a freshman in high school that you wanted to be a lawyer. But
yes.
Why was this? Why did you want to be a lawyer?
Well, my dad graduated from college in 1930, at the very beginning of the Depression. And he had planned on going to law school. And my dad became a teacher and an educator and became the director of special education for the Peoria schools and had a doctorate in education.
Mm-hmm.
But he had always talked about wanting to have been a lawyer. I'm thinking as a young child that I did it because I wanted to carry on something that he was not able to do and to please him, you know, to fulfill a wish that he couldn't fulfill.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of is the reason that I don't have any idea. I just knew from the beginning of high school I wanted to be a lawyer.
And what advice would you give to a young person who is trying to make a decision on what to do career-wise for the rest of their life?
Well, as I told my children, you either choose a profession that rewards you so you can live the way you want to live, or you choose a profession and then live the life that that profession can afford you. Because it's not often that you choose a profession that you like or love, and also it allows you to live the way you want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first choice you have to make. And then if you decide, well, this doesn't make any difference to me about my standard of living, I want to do this job, then that's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the best of all choices. When you choose a profession or a job because it allows you to live the way you want to live, that's a good choice too, but it doesn't give you as much enthusiasm for your work.
Yeah.
So it was really funny because when you take these career aptitude tests,
yeah,
teaching and law come out almost identical when you take those tests.
Mm-hmm.
When I took those tests, the two things that came right up to the top were teaching and law.
Wow.
And I couldn't figure that out for a while, but then I started thinking that both of those professions are professions of persuasion. You know, I was a trial lawyer, and you know, my job was to convince that jury to see the case in the light that I was presenting it. So you're persuading them to figure out and to follow the logic of how you have presented the facts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teaching is all about persuasion.
Yeah,
I think those aptitude tests really are helpful for someone who doesn't know what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my son didn't have any idea what he wanted to do. He went to Indiana University, had no idea what he wanted to major in, stayed in the university division as long as he could until they finally said he had to choose a college.
Yeah.
And so he chose the College of Public and Environmental Affairs because it would take everything that all his credits.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of his junior year, he got an opportunity to go out to Washington, D.C. to work for our congressman for the summer. And all of a sudden, Nelson knew exactly what he wanted to do. Came back for his senior year in college, finished up, went straight out to D.C., and has been there ever since.
Wow.
So, you know, he followed the trail of doing what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not worrying about what it was going to do for you or how you're going to live on it.
Yeah.
It worked out wonderfully for him.
Yeah. So when did you graduate from law school?
In 1962.
Okay. And then how/where did you begin your career as a lawyer?
Well, when I was in law school, I went to Senator Sowers and I said, I'd like to intern in your office for the summer between my second and third year of law school.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, my office is not really geared to have an intern, but he said that I know exactly where to send you. And so he called another lawyer that was a partner in largest firm in the city, and he said, I have a young man here that I'd like you to consider as an intern. So I interned at that firm the summer between my second and third year of law school.
Yeah.
And then they hired me when I graduated.
Okay.
I stayed there for about, 4 or 5 years. I realized I really liked to be my own boss.
Mm-hmm.
One time, the receptionist said they had a man for me to see, and so the guy came in, and he said, are you the head man here? And I said, well, it depends on which end you start. So I left there and then became partners with another lawyer, and then we had a firm, and the firm, then he became a judge, and I continued on with the firm and stayed there until I retired.
Yeah. And what did practicing law for all of those years teach you?
After you've begun a profession, suddenly your life and your persona is identified with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's Ron Litteris, the lawyer.
Yeah.
It's always tacked on. And then suddenly, when you, and you become very accustomed to that, and it's easy to live in that milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to have people accept your opinions because you are Ron Litteris, the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that follows you for a long time. And then suddenly you retire, and suddenly you're not Ron Litteris, the lawyer anymore. you know, you're just Ron Litterist. And so all that baggage, not all that baggage, but all that, almost like baggage, all that material that was carried with that name of lawyer,
yeah,
is suddenly erased.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And you're suddenly like everybody else.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
It was an interesting transition. Mm-hmm. Although, when I first started to practice with this firm, the senior partner was my age now, and he was not in good health.
Okay.
But he had done nothing in his life except practice law. He had no outside interests. He didn't do anything. So he'd come down to the office every day, and he would, you know, mess around and fool around with all the buttons on the telephone, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was no work for him to do. I mean, they didn't give him any work to do. And my office was next to his. And when he'd get bored, he'd start pushing a button when a light went on to get on a line, and he'd answer the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And this one day, he picked up the phone and, "What's your name?" And obviously, guy gave him his name. He said, "I can't hear you. What's your name? Say it again. What's your name?" So the guy said, apparently said it again. He said, "Well, I still don't get it. Why don't you spell it?" P-R-I-C-K. "Oh, hello, Mr. Prick." And the man's name was Blake.
Oh, no.
So they took the phone away from him. So that made a huge impression on me. I didn't want that to be my life.
Yeah.
I didn't want the practice of law to be the only thing that I did. Because that was the other part of when we were talking about what your parents teach you. Part of what my parents taught me was to be a volunteer, to give up my time.
Mm-hmm.
My parents both gave of their time a lot during their lives.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I'm not going to be all consumed. I'm not going to spend every minute of my day being a lawyer.
Yeah.
Which helped me, because when I retired, because I continued to volunteer and to do things. And so so when I retired, I still had all of that to do.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of your favorite memories or best memories from your time as a lawyer?
Winning.
It's always fun.
As opposed to losing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I represented people who were sued.
Okay.
For injury. They had been alleged to have caused someone else to be hurt. In other words, I represented a lot of insurance companies, because insurance companies had an obligation under your policy to give you adequate counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was one of those, quote, adequate counsel. So there were a lot of plaintiff's lawyers that I loved to beat, you know, and 40-some years, that was a good part.
Yeah. So transitioning into your children, how many children do you have?
I have two. I have Erica Gruner and Nelson Litterist, who is Rollin Nelson Litterist Jr.,
mm-hmm.
who I spoke of before.
Yeah.
I have two, and my wife, Lois, has three children.
Mm-hmm.
Brad, who lives in Lawrence, Kansas. Andrew, who lives in Ketchikan, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And Julie, who lives in Peoria.
Oh, wow. All over.
Yeah, all over the country.
Wow, that's awesome.
Spread around. Great awesome. Visiting.
Yeah, I'm sure. How old were you when your two children were born?
Erica was born in May, and so I was 30, almost 31. My birthday's in August.
Mm-hmm.
And Nelson was born in December, after my 33rd birthday.
Okay.
In those days, that was pretty old to have children, you know, your first children.
Yeah.
I wasn't married till I was 29.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Most of my friends of my first marriage, were all, you know, 8, 6, 7 years younger than I was.
Okay. And what lesson did you stress the most to your kids when they were growing up?
Well, I sort of stressed the lessons that my parents had given me. But in addition, I had a pledge brother that was Italian from East Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was first generation American, first generation in college. And his father pushed a vegetable wagon.
Okay.
In East Chicago. Our house was right across the street from the main buildings of campus, and my sleeping room faced the street, and I had German, and I hated it. And so I'd wait it was 8 o'clock class, and I'd wait to see if the professor for the German would drive by to go to the entrance of the college. And when he wouldn't, I could sleep in.
Mm-hmm.
So I was mentioning that to my pledge brother. I mean, by that time we were sophomores. And he said, "Well, are you happy?" And I said, "Well, because I don't have to go to class." He said, "Well, you paid for that class. When you don't get that class, they're cheating you out of your money." And suddenly he said, "I'm paying for every hour of my classes." And he said, "When a professor doesn't show up, I'm being cheated." So I always told that story to my kids. His name is Joe, and he's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a lawyer. He's not practicing anymore. But I would tell my kids that it illustrates that something of real value is something that you have earned.
Yeah.
Not something that's been given to you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You enjoy something that's given to you, but something you have earned has real value to you. And so that was one of the things I was always stressing with my kids.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any particularly funny stories from when your kids were little?
Well, Nelson went to a preschool at the Episcopal school here in Peoria.
Mm-hmm.
And he started as a three-year-old in three-year-old nursery. The principal's name was Father McDonald, but he would not call him Father McDonald. Because he already had a father.
Oh.
And then he stayed there until he was in through kindergarten. And in kindergarten, for Easter, we gave the kids colored ducks every year for Easter.
Yeah.
And, of course, they never lived, you know, because they'd be carrying them around and they'd break their neck or something would happen and they'd never live. But when Nelson was five, they both lived. And one was a male and one was a female. And so they were connecting all over the yard,
mm-hmm.
and the female was laying eggs all over the yard. And so one day I mentioned to the teacher that we had all these duck eggs. Oh, she said, "That'd be great." She said, "Bring them to school, so I'll get an incubator, and we'll hatch those eggs." And so Nelson and I carry this pasteboard box with about 25 or 30 eggs in it into his classroom.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher said, "Oh, look at these eggs. They're really nice." And she said, "Now, Nelson, we're going to take each one of these eggs and we're going to dip them in water. And then we're going to put them in the incubator. And then halfway through the day, we're going to turn them over and dip them on the other side and put them back in the incubator."
Yeah.
"And then after 29 days, they'll hatch if they're fertilized." And Nelson said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Dad did the whole yard last week." Yeah. And Erica, she started there also as a three-year-old, and they would have to go to a church service. We weren't Episcopalian, but that didn't hurt them to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first day when she comes home from school, we're having dinner, and so I asked, and she's three, and I asked Erica what she did that day. "Not too much. Ate the body of Christ, but only a tiny piece."
That's great.
And I told them, when they listen to this, they'll go, "Oh, no, God, we've heard that 120 times,
yeah,
probably more." But it's my favorite story about them.
That's so funny. What would you say is the most rewarding part about being a parent?
Because you have family.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people who have no children or aren't married realize until they get to my age how important those relationships are.
Mm-hmm.
And how important they are to you as a person.
Yeah.
How much luckier we are,
mm-hmm.
than people who have spent their life, you know, going on trips and not getting married or not having a family.
Yeah.
Because when they get to be in their 70s, they're pretty much alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful part of it.
Yeah. What parenting advice would you give to parents nowadays?
That balance between being a parent and friend is on a sliding scale. And you can't spend all your time as a parent being a disciplinarian, or as a friend, allowing your children to do whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. And where that line is depends on the child and depends on you. But I think you always have to keep in mind those two aspects of parenting.
And what would the Ron of today tell himself as a young husband and father?
I would tell him to stop and smell the roses. I'm a type A personality and firstborn, and you let a lot of time pass without savoring the moment, you know. You're worried about what's coming next, or you're thinking about what's coming next, or you're planning down the road.
Yeah.
But taking the time to savor what's happening right now, or to enjoy what's happening right now, is something. Erica and Nelson both do that. They both spend a great deal of time with their children, and always have.
Mm-hmm.
But part of that is, I think, a generational thing. I think that my grandfather's generation probably spent no time with their children, and my dad's generation spent a little bit of time with their children, and I spent more time with my children than my friends did.
Yeah.
But I still didn't spend nearly as much as Erica and Nelson do with their children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're with them, and they are there for them when they need help all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful, wonderful relationship.
Yeah.
Because, you know, children need to be loved, and they need to know they're loved, and they need you to not just say you love them, but to do things which show them that you love them.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie was, even after he got out of through a crib, when he had his first big bed, would not get out of his bed.
Really?
Until you came and got him. And so one day I was dressing him, and this was at their house in Evanston, and I was dressing him, and he was laying on the bed, and I was putting on his pants and things and shoes and socks, and I said, "Oh, Charlie," I said, "your mommy loves you, and your daddy loves you, and your grandma B loves you, your grandma A loves you, and I love you, and Louie loves you." "Yes," he says, "everybody loves me." And I thought, what a wonderful thing for a child to be able to say, you know, just how secure he had to be in his life.
To be able to say
that's a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. That is a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
So how and when did you meet your wife, Lois?
Well, I knew Lois. Probably from 1972. My first wife and I were chairman of a gala function for the symphony, and Lois and her husband, her then husband, served on our committee. And I think that's when I first met them.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, Lois, had met my first wife before that, and they had known each other before that.
Okay.
So I've known Lois for about 45 years.
Yeah. So then how did you two get together?
Well, Lois had been divorced about 17 years,
mm-hmm.
and lived in our neighborhood.
Okay.
And when my marriage ended, we just saw each other in the neighborhood. We'd have neighborhood meetings, or I'd just see her.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew all of her family. Her daughter was a close friend of my daughter and of Erica, and so we knew them.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been alone about 9 or 10 months, and I went down to Florida for Christmas to visit my parents, and I came back on the 29th of December because some friends had invited me to go with them on New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And so New Year's Eve was on Sunday, and I went to church, and Lois went to my same church, and during coffee hour I talked with her, and so I thought, to myself afterwards, gee, I wonder if she's doing anything on New Year's Eve. I could take her with me to friends.
Yeah.
So I called her, and she said, well, she didn't go out on New Year's Eve, and she didn't like go out New Year's Eve, and I said, well, I'm just going to visit some friends and have dinner with them at their house.
Yeah.
I said, sorry, it's late for me to sit in my house, and you sit in your house on New Year's Eve, and we could go visit them. That was our first date.
Mm-hmm.
It was on New Year's Eve in 96. Mm-hmm. I think.
And then how long did you date before you two decided to get married?
We got married in November of 98.
Okay. And how did you propose?
I took her to a Shakespeare festival down at Bloomington, Illinois. They have a Shakespearean, outdoor Shakespearean theater. Uh-huh. You can take your meal, you can take your picnic meal and have it on the lawn, and then you go into their outdoor theater and go to it.
Yeah.
So I got the ring, and I told the jeweler, who was a friend of mine, I said, well, she says no, can I bring the ring back? And he said, yeah, you can. And so I ordered a meal from a caterer here in Peoria to take down there with us, and I put the box under the radicchio
mm-hmm.
in the salad. And so she opened the meal, and she didn't eat anything, and I kept saying, well, don't you want to have some salad? No, I think I'll finish this glass of champagne.
Oh,
so we
okay.
finished the glass of champagne, and we're sitting on the ground. We have a blanket. And so I said, well, you know that salad that the woman made it, her name was Sid. I said, the Sid made was unusual salad. Well, she finally picked up the salad, of course, underneath that was the box with the ring in it.
Yeah.
And that's how I proposed to her.
Oh, I love that. How many years have you two been married?
22.
Oh, wow.
We were married 22 in November.
Wow.
November 25th. It was the day before Thanksgiving we got married.
Oh, how special.
The twins were 6 months old.
Oh.
And Lois's daughter, Julie, had a girl 10 days before the twins were born.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, Erica, when you'd be with her, and she'd say, you take this one, and you take that one. And, of course, this one might be that one 15 minutes later, and that one may be this one.
Yeah.
So I bought onesies. I had onesies made at a T-shirt shop. I got some onesies, and I had them on the T-shirt. I put them, had them put this one and that one. And then I got a third one that said the other one. That was for Julie's little girl.
Oh, that's so
cute. So it was this one, that one, and the other one.
I love that. So you and Lois obviously been married 22 years. What would you say is the key to a successful marriage?
Yes, dear. Well, she says yes, dear, to me, and I say yes, dear, to her.
Yeah. So how many grandchildren do you have, you and Lois?
Well, we have, between us, we have 12.
Oh, wow.
Let's see, three of them we've inherited because Lois's son married a woman that already had a boy.
Okay.
And Julie remarried and married a man that had two boys.
Okay.
So we still consider them our grandchildren, though. They run from 28 down to 2.
Oh, my goodness.
And the last one is one that lives in Ketchikan, Alaska, and his name is Whitman Henry Steamboat Lindner. So then our next youngest ones are two girls, my son's daughter, Abigail, and Brad's daughter, Alexandra. So we have Allie and Abby.
Uh-huh.
And they're both the same age, but they're 6 months apart. They're both now 14.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next after that is Joshua, who is Nelson's son.
Mm-hmm.
He's a junior in high school.
Yeah.
And then the next one is Charlie, and the next one is Brad's son Nicholas, who is about a year older than he'll just be turning 21 in March. And then we have Adele and Catherine and Jenna, the three girls that are 10 days apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Julie's stepson, Nate, who is 26, and his brother, Ryan, is 28.
All right. Wow. So what's your favorite part about being a grandpa?
Oh, my favorite part of being a grandpa is being with them.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy being with them all. Enjoy having an interest in the things they like to do. And now, you know, now so many of them are adults that, you know, it's really great to see them blossom,
yeah,
you know, into adulthood. And it's great to see the others who are a little bit younger,
mm-hmm,
to come into their own and do their own things. And they all have things that they really like to do. And most of them are athletic.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done really well in athletics. And then we have a toddler, which is great because we didn't have one
for so long.
We didn't have a new one. We didn't have a new one for 12 years.
Yeah.
It's nice to have him.
Mm-hmm. And then I hear that you and your family spend a lot of time in Door County, Wisconsin. When did you start going there?
I started going there when Nelson and Erica were, Erica was 4 and Nelson was 6.
Oh, wow.
And some friends of ours had a house in Door County that their family had had since, I don't know, 1904 or something like that. And so they invited us up to visit them. I had, as you know, I had gone to a camp in Minnesota, Camp Mishawaka.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought real men went to Minnesota and wusses went to Wisconsin. And so when we went there to Door County, I really loved it because I did a lot of sailing. I had a sailboat. And yet it wasn't like being out in the woods. You know, in Minnesota, you're out in the woods. And in Wisconsin, you have towns and you can be out in the woods if you want to, but you can also be in town. So it was really, it was a neat place to be. So we would go there with the other family, but not stay with them. We'd stay in a resort that was next door to their house.
Okay.
And we would go up at the same time as they did.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just kept doing that for a lot of years. And then when both of our families changed, our new wives came too.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the house we have now 6 months after we were married, so Lois's children and all of our grandchildren, all the grandchildren have never known any other place. They all come. Every year they all come and they all love it.
Mm-hmm. And what's your favorite part or what are your best memories from your time spent there?
The best memories are the friends we've made there over the years. We have a lot of friends that we keep in contact with all the time that are they're seasonal people like we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all look forward to seeing each other and doing things together. We have a yacht club up there in Ephraim that we all, most of us belong to, and
yeah,
we all have a lot of interests in common, and so I think the best memories of all there are our friendships there.
Mm-hmm. So I know we just kind of mentioned it, but Camp Mishawaka, when did you start going there?
Well, my dad was, as I said, was an educator, and so we started going there in 1945.
Oh, wow.
And my dad then was only working 9 months a year, so he had the whole summer off. And my dad loved fishing and hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. I mean, my dad was a passionate fisherman and a passionate hunter. And so he got an opportunity to be the head counselor of a portion of Camp Mishawaka.
Mm-hmm.
Because Camp Mishawaka was a boys' camp originally. And they had one of the camps was for 9 and 10-year-olds, and then there was a camp for 11 and 12-year-olds, and there was a camp for 13 and up. And my dad was the head counselor for the building camp, which was for the youngest kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we started going there when I was 9 years old. And my mother and our family lived in a cottage on the property owned by the camp, but it was, a half a mile downshore. And most of the counselors' wives lived there. There were about 6 or 7 cottages. But I started going to camp there when I was 9, and I went until I was 14.
Okay.
So even when I had a paper route, I would be, and the camp was from June to August, so mm-hmm. I would get someone else to take my paper route when I was gone. So I'd go up there to camp every year.
Mm-hmm.
And I went until I was through the 14th year. And it was a wonderful experience because it was a trip camp. And when you went out on trips into Canada by canoe. And
oh, my goodness.
10 days at a time.
Wow.
Carry everything on your back and carry the canoes. And,
wow.
Yeah, it was a great experience. Besides my fraternity, that experience at camp was really fundamental in what I feel about being self-reliant.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can live even though the electricity goes off And there are a lot of people that don't understand that. You know, they think the whole world ends when electricity goes off.
Yeah.
So I was really lucky. And almost all the campers came from really wealthy families, and a lot of them came from Tulsa and Bartlesville, Oklahoma, because their parents were all oil people.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of Chicago people there. The Evan Roots from Milwaukee were there. A lot of the beer people, children were there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really great experience for me to be there.
Yeah.
And so Nelson went there, and Erica went there, and Charlie, Adele, and Catherine went there. We've had three generations go there.
That's pretty neat.
My brother went there. My brother went there for a little bit. He didn't like it so much.
Really?
Yeah, he didn't care for it as much. Well, by that time, we owned the farm, and we had a farmer that farmed the farm for us, but, you know, my brother loved to traipse in the woods and hunt, and so he was just as happy being on our farm, and we had a lake on the farm, and so he could swim, and, you know, he could do all the things he only went there a couple of years.
Yeah. What are some other favorite vacations or places that you've been, and why?
Well, we've been to, Lois and I've been to Ireland, and we went there for a wedding.
Oh, wow.
A friend of ours, son, a doctor in New York, married a girl from Dublin, Ireland, who was in New York. But the wedding was in Ireland, so we went for the wedding, and then we spent another couple of weeks in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Loved that. My wife has been, her father-in-law, when she was married the first time, took the whole family to Europe.
Wow.
So she had been every place. But we've been to Belgium. We've been to over Valentine's Day in 1 year. And we went to Italy 4 years ago. Went to Rome, Venice, and Florence. Loved that. And then last year we went to Spain because Adele and Catherine were there for their semester abroad. And so we went to visit them, and then we went on from Madrid after we were with them. We went on a Rhodes Scholar tour to Cordova, Toledo, Sevilla.
Wow.
And we were another 2 weeks on that trip. Had a great time. Loved being there in Madrid with the girls and have them speaking fluent Spanish, and just had a great time with them in Madrid.
Yeah. So I hear you're an accomplished artist. You do watercolor?
I do.
And how long have you done that? Yeah.
I started when I was 70 years old.
Okay.
Erica gave me a gift certificate to the art school in Door County, thinking that I think she thought I was going to buy something.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, gee, I think I'd like to try painting. So I took a class in watercolor for beginners and sort of got hooked on it. I had been president of the Arts and Science Council here that had about 50 arts groups, and I had been a trustee of the museum here, and so I had been around artists almost all the time that I was working.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, gee, I think I'll try painting, and I got, well, it came at a perfect time because I was talking about retiring and not knowing your identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to paint. Pretty soon people started saying, oh, yeah, you're the artist. So now I have a new title.
Yeah.
I have a new title to tag on to my name besides a blank.
Mm-hmm.
But I really have enjoyed doing it. And I give paintings to organizations to raffle for fundraisers. And I give every relative in the world a painting. Or two, or three, or four.
Yeah.
I sell some.
Oh, wow. Really?
I do sell some. I mean, if someone asks me to buy one, sure, that's fine. I'll sell them to them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go out and seek. 1 year I did. 1 year I was in a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
It was before I had my bladder cancer, the year before. But I've never done that since. I don't know. It takes... It then becomes a business.
Yeah, like, it's a job, not a hobby.
Yeah, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Takes all the joy out of it.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
But the one thing I regret is that I didn't start earlier.
Really? Yeah.
I mean, I think maybe I might have been able to do something more substantial if I had started earlier. If I'd started 20, 25 years earlier, I think I could have maybe been more accomplished.
Yeah. So you ride your bike, which obviously right now it's been difficult with your hip, but you usually ride your bike 25 miles twice a week. When did you start doing that?
Well, actually, cycling has not bothered my hip.
Oh, it hasn't?
No. It's the strangest thing in the world. I could ride my bike. In fact, I go to the Y here a lot, and I ride a half hour every time I'm there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I won't be riding for the next, obviously for the next month or so, but it didn't bother me. I started riding, I was trying to remember when you approached me about this, I was trying to remember when I started riding. I know it was before Erica rode in the Little 500 when she was in school. And I know it was before that I was riding. And I don't remember it. So it would have been sometime in the early, maybe in the, I ran. I was a runner. I ran starting in 1970 until I had my heart attack in 99. I ran. But I started riding about, I'd say, in the early 80s.
Okay. And why do you enjoy this so much?
Because I ran, and I rode my bike when I was working because it freed your mind from what you were thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
You get in, when you're running or when you're cycling, you get into a sort of, not a trance, but you get into a, if you're riding alone, getting into an area where you're free of the things that you've been thinking about or worrying about. When I ride with a group, of course, you talk.
Yeah.
But when I ride alone, it's a great way to relieve tension and stress.
So when did you retire and why?
I retired I had a heart attack in 1999. We were married 6 months and I had a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
And it was what they call the widow's artery.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that less than 50% of people, when they have the attack, survive it.
Oh, my.
And when I had the attack, my cholesterol was within normal limits. My triglycerides were within normal limits. My proteins were within normal limits. So they decided that they would call it spontaneous stenosis, which means we don't have any idea what caused it.
Oh, my gosh.
I had never had a symptom before, and I've never had a symptom since. But I figured it was stress. And so I figured, why in the world am I doing this for everybody else? I'm not, you know, you get ready to go on vacation. This is in the days before cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
You get ready for vacation, and everybody knew you were going on vacation. So the whole day before you were leaving on vacation, people would be calling you about things they'd want to have done before you left.
Yeah.
And so you were all bound up by the time you left. And I thought, why am I doing this? You know, I need to live. So I started then readying my firm for me to leave. And I left at the end of 2002.
Okay.
Lois was teaching. Lois was a special ed teacher, and she was teaching, and she was retiring in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good time.
Yeah.
And we already had the house.
Yeah. And how have you spent your retirement?
Well, the first thing I did after I retired was to start volunteering in schools. I volunteered in an inner city school, having my dad in education and my wife as a teacher. And as I said, those career tests told me that teaching was in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
So I started volunteering in an inner city school, and I did that until last March when the pandemic started.
Oh, wow.
And I followed one teacher for about 14 years. Wherever she went, I went. And I would do it one day a week, one half day a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for 14 years. And she went from second grade to third grade, and then she went to kindergarten, and then she went to the behavioral school. She had a degree in behavioral problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we were, the last 2-3 years, I was with her in a locked-up building. All the rooms were locked.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
You had 4 or 5 kids. This was first to fourth grade that we were doing. So I did that for 2.5 years. And it was a great, I had a lot of experiences that were just I mean, the kinds of kids that we were with were just, it was sad. An old girl that I asked her about Christmas, and she said, well, we're not going to have a tree this Christmas. And I said, well, why? So, because my dad bought drugs with everything. And so I bought her a star to put on top of her tree. And a little boy, we were reading a book about a dog, and so it's another year, and I asked the little boy if he had a dog. He said, yeah, he had a dog. And I said, well, what's he like now? Oh, well, I don't have him anymore. He says, my uncle came over and shot that dog dead. Bang, bang, bang. And you think, oh.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, that's sad stories.
Yeah, well.
Sad stories. So it was really rewarding when they would, you know, open up to you, or it was a great experience.
Yeah, wow. And then 10 years ago, you survived bladder cancer. Could you explain the process of your diagnosis and treatment?
Well, it wasn't 10 years ago. It was 2012, so it was...
Oh, okay.
It was eight years ago.
Okay.
One night I was going to bed, and I decided to take a leak before I went to bed, and when I did, the bowl was the color of tomato soup. So I called my doctor, and my doctor wasn't in, and another doctor prescribed a medication, and I said, well, it's not an infection because there's so much blood. Well, they gave it to me anyway, but my doctor came back from vacation, which was the next Monday. He immediately ordered x-rays and found that I had two tumors in my bladder, which they took out. But then I had to have my bladder and my prostate removed.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that done in Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And then I had chemotherapy back here for about 5 months.
Mm-hmm. And what was your mindset during that time period?
Well, I remember going to church, and the minister came up to me and said, you know, if you feel bad and feel upset and want to see me, come and see me. And I was sort of surprised at that, because my attitude is that I'm along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
And always has been my attitude. I mean, I had no pain, I had no symptoms, I had nothing, and we're flying to Baltimore, and I said to my wife, you know, this is the only time in the world where you go to a hospital and you end up feeling worse when you leave than when you came.
Yeah.
You know, because I had had surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided that I'm, at that time, 75 years old. I've had a great marriage. I have wonderful children, and I have wonderful grandchildren, and there are a lot of people in this world who would give their right arm to have half the life I've had. So whatever comes, comes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm along for the ride, and that's what has been my motto ever since.
Yeah.
And when the virus came and everybody's getting scared and all upset, and I don't go out and run out and look for ways to get sick, but you can't hole up in the house and do nothing, you know? So I'm along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, happens.
Yeah, that's a great motto. So then could you describe how you felt then when you found out that you were cancer-free?
Well, I'm not cancer-free.
You're not?
No. I'm free of bladder cancer, but 5 years, they follow you for 5 years, and I was in my last appointment with the oncologist for the 5 years, and I said, you know, you're not just going to release me. I mean, certainly you're going to do a scan to see what condition I'm in now.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. And so we were just leaving for Door County, and so we'll schedule it for September. So I came back in September, and he did the scans, and he said, well, you have CLL, which is chronic lymphatic lymphoma.
Oh, my.
And I said, oh, my. And he said, well, there's nothing to do for it. All we do is just watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have for the last 2 years or 2.5 years, I go every 6 months and do all sorts of blood tests, and everything's normal, and I go home.
Wow.
So if you have to have it, something, it's the best to have.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, though, still.
Well, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I don't feel fatigued. I really don't think about it very often.
Yeah.
But the fact is, I do have a form of lymphoma, which is in the lymph nodes of my body.
And then you're having your hip replaced in a couple of days.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I sound like I'm a wreck, don't I?
So
cut all this out of this interview.
Okay.
Oh, dear.
When did your hip start giving you problems?
I had a back problem for probably 50 years,
mm-hmm.
55 years maybe. And I work out a lot to keep my back limber.
Mm-hmm.
And when they shut down all the gyms, of course, I couldn't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And my back started tightening up and my hips started bothering me. And I really didn't know whether it was my hip or my back. And then they opened up in Door County. They opened up all the Y up there. They opened up in June. And I was able to go there and work out. And pretty soon I realized it wasn't my back, because my back was now flexible and I was free of pain, but it was my hip.
Oh, yeah.
So then I came back, saw a neurologist that said, no, it's your back. And then I saw an orthopod who took x-rays and said, yeah, it's your hip. It's bone on bone. That means I'm having surgery.
Yeah.
And day after tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, that's...
Can't wait.
Yeah, I bet. So you've experienced and seen so much in your life. What do you think of the world right now?
Let's see. We've been on the phone 2 hours. Do you have another 2 hours to talk about the world? The world is plagued by an addiction to cell phones, number one. And I don't know how anybody can stop and smell the roses if they have a cell phone that they're constantly looking at their,
mm-hmm.
they're looking up all their text messages. And me, yesterday I was at the Y, and there were only two of us in the weight room. This other guy in the weight room was young. He was probably about 23, 24, 25. And the only thing he carried with him from station to station was his cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that he went to a station, he put it down on the floor next to the station, and he did the exercise. And then the first thing he did was pick up his cell phone and start looking at what had happened while he was a minute and a half or 2 minutes on that machine.
Oh, wow.
And then he would go pick up his phone and take it to the next station, put it down, and do this over and over again. And I thought to myself, how can you, anybody be that glued? I mean, that's just very foreign to me. But the other part of the cell phone is that nothing now is timed. Everything is immediate.
Yeah.
Because the cell phone takes pictures of everything that happens and sends it all over the world. And you start a text, and pretty soon the text is all over the world. And suddenly everybody is all in a titter, you know?
Yeah.
And I just don't know what, because no one is sitting back and absorbing the information they get to determine whether it's right or wrong.
Yeah.
I had a grandson in Kansas. We were having a discussion. He said, well, I'll look it up on Google, a question. He said, well, I'll look it up on Google. So he looked up on Google, and he said, this is the answer. And I said, well, how do you know that's the answer? Well, it's on Google. Well, where do you think Google gets their answer?
Oh.
I don't know. But it's got to be right. It's on Google. Yeah, he's in high school, but, you know, still.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, nobody today is absorbing information and looking for themselves to decide what the answer should be or what the truth of the fact is.
Mm-hmm.
Or the schools now. I mean,
yeah.
Charlie's friends have told me about classes they have at DePauw where the teacher is mouthing real political things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, wow, I mean, we're going to have a generation of young people that just don't have any concept of, they've had life, you know, pretty easy, and
mm-hmm.
and they don't have any idea except the stuff that they are fed.
Yeah. As you look back on your life, who are the people who have influenced you or impacted you the most?
Well, my parents are one. The lawyer I was talking about, he obviously had a great deal of influence on me. And one of the partners of the law firm that I was first with, he happened to be the son-in-law of the older gentleman I was talking about. And he was very helpful to me about how to conduct my life outside of the practice of law.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that we talked about were things that I have followed, and the kinds of people that I've associated with and the kinds of activities that I've gotten into are not exactly the groups that he talked about, but the values that he talked about are things that have been helpful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was two women. One was a mother of a friend of ours who was a very strong woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a lot of confidence in me and had a lot of suggestions for me and had a lot of introduced me to a lot of people and things that were helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is another woman whose name was Blanche. She was married 3 times and buried 3 husbands.
Oh, wow.
Her last husband's name was Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And she died a few years ago at 102.
Okay.
But she always was around younger people. And I think I got from her that when you get to be my age, you don't want to put yourself in a cocoon and only see people that think like you do and talk like you do and act like you do. You want to get out and you want to see other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be around younger people. And that was one of the reasons why, by my being the advisor at my fraternity, was so important, was that I could hear them talk about what they wanted to do and how they wanted to act and who they wanted to see without being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
When I would be judgmental with my own children when they said the same things.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was really important. It's really been an important lesson from that woman that you don't want to look backwards.
Uh-huh.
You only want to look forward.
Yeah, I like that. Would you say that you have a favorite memory or time period of your life?
Well, the present is my favorite. What I just talked about, I don't like to look back. I mean, right now is the happiest and the most content I've been in my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have said that 5 years ago. I would have said that 10 years ago. Not so sure I would have said it 30 years ago. But the present is always the best, you know,
yeah.
To me.
Yeah. Do you regret anything?
Oh, sure. There are lots of things you regret. But the problem with regretting is that if you hold on to those regrets, you know, they color what you do and what you know. I've had regrets. I've had regrets about my first marriage, and I've had regrets about things I've done as a lawyer, you know, mm-hmm. from
yeah.
time to time. But I don't dwell on those.
Yeah. What advice would you give to my generation?
I would advise your generation to think for yourself and to have a great deal of respect for your relationships that you have with others.
Yeah. And what do you believe is the most important thing in life?
Not to be corny, but I think love is the most important thing because it drives relationships, it drives you. You know, I think that if I were to pick some word that would most affect us all, each of us in our own way, it's word love.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, one more question. What do you hope to be remembered by?
I hope that I gave a eulogy of one of the women that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I said the greatest thing for her is to be remembered by people talking about her. I think that's the greatest gift that any of us can have, is to be remembered, to have people remember you, talk about you, say things that they recall that you talked about or that values you stood for.
Mm-hmm.
Because that really, to me, is the essence of what your successful life has been.
Yeah.
You know, is to have people talk about you in
yeah.
a good way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ron Litteris, the lawyer, the painter, the cyclist, the husband, the father, the grandfather, Ron Litteris, the great man. No matter what title you know Ron Litteris as, he has been along for the ride in each role, looking forwards, not backwards, and advising everyone to stop and smell the roses along the way. For Ron hopes to be remembered by people talking about him, and anyone who has had the pleasure of meeting Ron can attest that talking positively about him is easy now and will be forever.
I make a lot of homemade ice cream.
Oh.
But Lois is a great cook, and we do a lot of cooking together.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
She'll make part of the meal, and I make part of the meal. And
yeah.
Yeah, we both enjoy to cook. My mother was a great cook.
She was.
As well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was a really great cook.
Mm-hmm.
So, I came from a mother is a great cook, and I have a wife that's a great cook, and so.
Yeah, you've been set all your life.
That's right. And then we, as you have down here, Lois and I play a lot of bridge.
Mm-hmm.
We do that together. We play, but she and I play.
Yeah.
I paint, cycle. I like to work in the yard at both this house and the house up in Door County.
Yeah.
I had a grandfather who just loved to work with flowers and plants. I guess I inherited that.
Yeah.
Because I do it too. And so when they got done, I raised my hand and he acknowledged me. And I said, well, you haven't counted how many men went to Wabash and had to have their girls go to DePauw to be close.
I love that.
He wasn't real happy with
me. Yeah, probably not.